It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Traumatic brain injury. Now, over the past few years, it's been more and more present in our news. Also a bigger and bigger concern, not only because of our veterans who have returned from wars, many of them have to deal with the aftermath of traumatic brain injury, also because of the growing knowledge we have about the impact of traumatic brain injury in, for instance, contact sports that our kids play. Each year, tens of thousands of Iowans are hospitalized or seen in emergency rooms due to traumatic brain injury. You can add to that the number of Iowans, we don't know that number, who experience traumatic brain injury, some sort of brain injury, the ones who do not seek medical treatment. This hour, our focus is on traumatic brain injury to learn about some of the latest research and treatment, also to get perspectives from a number of Iowa veterans later in the hour. Joining us for the entire hour, Michael Hall is with us. He's a staff neuropsychologist at the Iowa City Veterans Administration Healthcare System, director of something called the Iowa Consortium of Veteran Excellence, called goes by the acronym ICOVE. We'll learn more about that later in the program. Adjunct assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Iowa Carver School of Medicine. Michael Hall, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me back again. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's make sure we know what we're talking about, because it spans a wide range of things. Define it more precisely than I have in the first start. This ranges from what to what?
So first off, this March is TBI Awareness Month, and Governor Branstad recently signed a proclamation again. So we want to create awareness about traumatic brain injury. So if you think about traumatic brain injury, essentially what it is some sort of blow or force to the head or brain that disrupts mental functioning. And this can range significantly. So it can be a concussion where somebody feels dazed and confused, all the way up to maybe some post-traumatic amnesia, which is not remembering a little bit of what happened before or after, to prolonged loss of consciousness. And what we do is we typically categorize brain injuries into mild, moderate, and severe. So a mild brain injury is any kind of concussion or brain injury with a loss of consciousness up to about 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. Between 30 minutes and 24 hours of loss of consciousness is a moderate traumatic brain injury, and then beyond 24 hours is a severe traumatic brain injury. And that's somewhat complicated if there's abnormal neuroimaging findings. But in general, fortunately, the most of what we see is mild traumatic brain injury. And certainly when we think about the NFL and a lot of the veterans experience, we're seeing a lot of repetitive concussions and repetitive mild traumatic brain injuries. We still see the severe and the moderate traumatic brain injuries as well. But I think if you look at the media, certainly a lot of attention has switched to the mild traumatic brain injury or concussion issue.
And then even if it's mild, if it's repetitive, it can do quite a bit of damage. We're finding out more and more about that.
Yeah, well, particularly with repetitive injuries, we worry about something called secondary impact syndrome. So if you have a concussion and you don't fully recover and then have another concussion immediately within that, during that recovery time, it can lead to some catastrophic events. And then there's concern, and this is particularly, highlighted out of a lot of what's coming out of the NFL and the NCAA, that with repetitive concussions and repetitive head injuries, there are instances where brain pathology is showing that essentially the brains of 30 and 40-year-olds are looking like the brains of 70-year-olds with Alzheimer's disease, because essentially what's happening is our plaques and tangles are being generated and sort of mucking up the way the brain works, if you will. So we have concerns about, repetitive injuries and then the more moderate severe injuries. Just one caveat on that is it's important, to acknowledge brain injury. It's underdiagnosed. There are issues with overdiagnosis. So if I say you come into me, you've had a concussion, and I say you're going to have memory problems. And from then on out, you say every time I have a memory problem, it's related to that traumatic brain injury. It causes what we call iatrogenic effects. So it's sort of an over-attribution. And the issue with that is it can be self-limiting. So I have a traumatic brain injury, so I can't do this or that. And really within the recovery rehabilitation models that we really, have found to be very effective, we want people to try to work as much as they can past, the injuries and develop compensatory strategies to work on, again, rehabilitation. Just before one other quick thing, with traumatic brain injury, both civilian and in the military, it's very common that we don't just see traumatic brain injury in isolation. We often see orthopedic injuries, and you can think about that for a car accident, mood changes, a lot of other things. So it really becomes a very complex process very quickly.
Michael Hall is with us, neuropsychologist at the Iowa City Veterans Administration Healthcare System. Your questions about traumatic brain injury, welcome this hour. 1-866-780-9100. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. If it's touched you, if you face the aftermath of a traumatic brain injury, tell us about it on our Facebook page, for instance, Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page, or tweet us at IPR Talk. The awareness, just in the time that I've been behind the microphone at Iowa Public Radio doing this talk show, I noticed a dramatic uptick in awareness about traumatic brain injury. We had recently in the news former Michigan starting center Jack Miller announcing that he's not going to play his senior season. The reason, one of them, he cited, is concern about the long-term impact from past and possible future concussions. This is something we wouldn't have heard from this sport 10, 15 years ago.
I don't think we would have heard this 5 years ago or maybe even 3 years ago. So a lot of attention is being paid on what's called CTE or chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is that cumulative impact in people who have multiple concussions or multiple exposures. And in listening to both the Michigan person and then I think there was a professional athlete who retired after his rookie season with millions of dollars in contracts, I can understand why that person would do that, because if you have brain damage and you damage, you know, key parts of the brain, your quality of life, no matter how much money or how much success you have, is going to be markedly affected. You know, brain injury and repetitive brain injury and severe brain injury are significant public health issues. You know, you mentioned some numbers. It's estimated that about 3 million to 5.3 million Americans are dealing with long-term consequences of brain injury. About 1.7 million suffer either concussion or brain injury a year in this country. 35% of those are from falls, 17% from motor vehicle accidents, 17% being struck by objects is about 16%, and then assault about 10%, and 20% is about, you know, just a variety of other things. And brain injury is the leading cause of disability among children, death in children and young adults. So this contact sports issue comes into play. Wearing helmets comes into play.
Okay, you talked about the severity of the problem.
Yeah.
Before we meet our veterans, let's talk a little bit about the rehabilitation, that side, a little bit more
Absolutely.
In depth. What have we learned recently? What advances have been made in regards to rehabilitation once we have the brain injury?
Right. So there's a standard of, I think, a growing acknowledgement of a rehabilitation process, which is multimodal in nature and holistic. So when we're doing rehabilitation with somebody with a brain injury, we want to make sure that the key partners are at the table, and that includes the individual with the brain injury, the family, the physicians that may be, you know, taking care of physical injuries, certainly the rehabilitative specialists like speech pathologists, occupational therapists, physical therapists, all at the table to come up with a working plan and then follow through with that. So I think we're getting better at team rehabilitation. Working in the VA in my 10 years, I've seen the development of the polytrauma care system, which has essentially different levels of acuity. And it's been very impressive to see that system develop and the services we're able to provide. Other areas other institutions are doing really great work. University of Iowa is coming out with some recent research that is incredibly interesting, along with some other colleagues, finding some neuroprotective agents that may actually protect against some of the long-term damage of brain injury and other potentially neurodevelopmental diseases.
Mm-hmm.
The more we learn, I think the better we're going to do as far as long-term management. And I can talk about some other of the more, I don't know if it would be considered sexy, but some of the more exciting new potentials
let's hold up on that.
Okay.
Let's hold up that on a moment. Okay. I'm definitely interested in that. But help us understand the injury to a brain. We break our arm, we break our mm-hmm. wrist, something like that. Due to some impact, we talk about healing, that the body mending the bone again, the tissue. Does that same sort of thing happen in the brain, or what do we know about that?
Well, so early in my training, the concept was if you lost it, it wouldn't come back. However, some of the research I just mentioned out of the University of Iowa and other research does show that there's something called neuroplasticity, that there is recovery of brain functioning after a brain injury. Part of that depends on the severity. Part of that depends on intervention, how quickly it happens. If somebody has swelling in the brain and that's not dealt with, that can lead to long-term damage. There's a lot of variability as far as that goes.
Okay. Now tell me about some of the, what you said, are sexy advances here. We've got some technology in here. I'm looking at my notes here. The interesting things popping up here, aren't
they? Yeah. So essentially, this was really a traumatic brain injury, not only just through the NFL and through the NCAA, but also through our experiences both in Iraq and Afghanistan. It really highlighted the importance of we don't know enough. We need to know more, and we need to do better. So just out of the university here, I was recently involved in a study with Ricardo Jorge, who's unfortunately gone on to Texas, but looking at essentially microscopic damage that happens after a mild traumatic brain injury and correlating that back to some cognitive difficulties. So we're starting – hopefully that will lead to better identification and diagnosis of brain injury, because oftentimes it is confounded or complicated if somebody also has, say, depression or post-traumatic stress disorder or musculoskeletal problems, all of which can in some ways mimic some of the symptoms of traumatic brain injury. So detangling the different problems is often a challenge. Some of the other things essentially in my time in the VA, a huge amount of money was dedicated to research both on detection of brain injury and then treatment of brain injury. So some of the more interesting things that I think we've talked about this sort of off air is that there's currently work on a smell test to test the olfactory system as an indicator of brain injury, because if we can catch somebody in the field or say they're a paramedic or somebody who's dealing with troops that have had that exposure, we want to get them out of the theater or out of that situation.
So they cease to smell certain smells?
Well, the idea behind this isn't quite so new, but it's sort of one of these new projects that are coming out, is that we have a number of cranial nerves that control some of our senses, and one of them controls the olfactory senses. And if you get some damage to your brain, you can impinge on that nerve or cut that nerve. So if somebody does lose their sense of smell after a brain injury, that can be, pathognomonic of a brain injury. Now, you can lose that for cold, other things, but certainly in that respect. Some of the other interesting technology that's coming out are there's smartphone apps that have the ability to plug in EEG wires to look at brain activity following a blast.
And EEG measures, measures the electricity in the brain.
Usually, we usually look for seizures with that, but some of this, and I was just reading about a new protocol that's coming out that may be able to not just look for seizures, but also look for disruption in brain functioning immediately after. We also, in the field, certainly within the military, we want to do very rapid, assessments in the field of cognition and other key physical signs such as balance, nausea, those sorts of things. So quickly getting better, getting to it quicker and then providing intervention quicker, we know that results in better outcomes later on down the road.
Michael Hall is a neuropsychologist at the Iowa City VA healthcare system, talking about traumatic brain injury, awareness, how to identify it, also treatment, the research that's being done about it as it comes more and more into our lives. It's actually been there a long time, but
yes,
we are learning more in these past few years than we have in decades before, I have the feeling.
Absolutely. And this is one of the things that often does come out of war is that we have advances in medicine. So given these two conflicts, traumatic brain injury has been one of the hallmark injuries of the war. So that's directed a lot of attention. And then to be followed up by the issues within the NFL, NHL, and some of the settlements that will provide research dollars as well. I think, 10 years from now, we're going to be having a very different discussion about brain injury and the implications and what we're able to do to provide treatment.
Okay. Let's meet our veterans in the Iowa City studio along with Michael Hall. Josh Mulder is with us. He's a veteran, also a veteran of the war in Afghanistan. Josh Mulder, welcome to our program.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Nate Warner is alongside Josh there, a University of Iowa student. Josh, I believe you are too. Nate, you served in Afghanistan as a platoon medic with an infantry company. Welcome to you.
Thanks.
And Stephanie Woodell is a student at the University of Iowa, also an Iraq War veteran. Stephanie, welcome to you. And all at once, I want to thank you for your service to our country. Let's start with you, Josh. You sustained a blast-related injury. Tell us about the day you were wounded.
We were doing a patrol, and one of our guys from that was in our squad stepped on IED and lived through it and all that. But the blast, I got checked out by our corpsman and diagnosed me with a concussion. And on top of that, my platoon found, I couldn't tell the exact number. I know it was over about 80 IEDs. And when you find all those IEDs, you have to do a controlled detonation to get rid of them. And so when we're around all those blasts and just the whole time I was in country, after I got out, got diagnosed with a TBI from the VA.
Mm-hmm. What were the first symptoms you noticed, brain-related injury symptoms that you noticed on that day? Were you unconscious for a while?
No, the blast knocked me back a little bit. Definitely, like, had a concussion, the typical concussion symptoms that a lot of people get, between, like, getting your brain rattled and, like, the ringing in your ears and all that and whatnot. And when we got back, like I said, our corpsman checked me out and a few other Marines. And that's when he was like, yeah, you definitely got a concussion.
Mm-hmm. What was the diagnosis? Any specifics on that you can give us?
As far as the test, I couldn't tell you what it was okay. or what they all did. I couldn't remember. And
which is an important point because, you know, oftentimes we do, and Nate can address this as well, is that one of the symptoms of a traumatic brain injury is potentially post-traumatic amnesia. So when I was talking to Josh earlier, I said, well, what happened after you got back? And he goes, I don't know. I had no memory of that, which is very, you know, not uncommon at all, even if somebody doesn't lose consciousness. So we call that post-traumatic amnesia.
Mm, okay. So what symptoms, Josh, are you dealing with today and how— How far in the past is this injury?
This happened in 2010. Mm-hmm. So still to this day, it's just pretty much you got to do set a lot of patterns because especially for me, like my short-term memory isn't the best.
Set a lot of patterns. What's
yep.
that?
As far as like when I get home, like I take out my wallet and I put a certain place. I put
routine.
My keys a certain place. Yeah, certain routine, certain patterns just so you don't. Forget something and you just get in the habit of doing all those routines and just it's one of those things that it helps you like live a normal life and just like helping cope with everything else that comes with it and especially like having like a certain like attention memory span before like my brain will like shut off and like float away and so it's just one of those things that you definitely have to learn how to deal with and cope with.
In the studio along with us, we have your service dog, Traveler, is
yep.
at your feet under the table there, a beautiful black lab, I believe. Does Traveler help you out with these symptoms?
Yes, Traveler, he can do a lot of stuff. It still blows my mind to this day. I got him in April of last year, and Traveler, he's a very well-trained dog. Definitely a lot of money went into him. There's some things that Traveler can help me out with. He can turn the lights on and off, so I start to have a nightmare. He can sense it, and he'll wake me up, and he'll turn the lights on.
Does he go to a switch? Does he jump
yep.
up on a switch?
Yep. Yeah. He can do the light switches. A lot of the other dogs that can do it as well, they're all trained with push-button lights, and so they can do that, and then they can move up to the actual light switches. And so he can pick up on the moods I'm in. So if I'm in, like a sad or depressed mood, or if I have, like, a really bad anxiety attack, he'll pick up on that. And he'll, like, just be all up in me and make me start petting him just to mm-hmm. take my mind off of whatever it is that's bothering me. He can clear my apartment. And so when I get to my apartment, I can tell him to clear it, and he'll go from room to room and sit and make sure nobody's in there.
Lowers your anxiety that
yep.
way.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What about out in the public? Does he work so that I know
yep.
you mentioned some anxiety issues,
yeah.
Perhaps crowded areas?
Yep, crowded areas, loud noises is something like scares me or like startles me. He'll turn to me and like knock his head on my hand and get me to pet him. It works just even on like a normal basis where he's in the back of my truck and I just look out. my mirror, and I just see his ears flopping around in the wind, and just to give me a smile, just help brighten my day.
That sounds wonderful. Josh Mulder, with us, a veteran of Afghanistan, has sustained a traumatic brain injury after an explosion in Afghanistan, talking about coping these days now, about 5 years after that explosion and the wound. Nate Warner, you served in Afghanistan as well. You served there as a platoon medic with an infantry company. How often as a combat medic did you need to identify and treat traumatic brain injury?
I don't know. It seemed like when I was there, it's kind of in spurts, so you can't really put a figure on it if you had to, you know, guesstimate. I don't know. Every week or two, probably some kind of incident happening in the more busier places in Afghanistan.
You have an explosion in the field. You're there with your company. How do you identify TBI?
Well, for me, anyways, the first step, TBI is. It's just part of like your standard evaluation. So usually there's other things associated with that. So if someone's having a TBI in the field, they're probably involved in an IED or something like that, some kind of blast. And so it's just part of your primary evaluation, and you're looking for significant life-threatening injuries. That's what I was trained to do. So I'm looking for what would cause them to die right there on the spot and treat that, and then you kind of gather more information as you're treating them, and so you look for like that altered mental status, and as you get time, if you get time for more detailed examination depending on the extent of their injuries, then you can look things for like the unequal pupils and things like that, and amnesia, and the more like apparent signs. But in the field, it's kind of hard to diagnose and see, because a lot of times the people aren't necessarily unconscious. If they're unconscious from a blast, it's usually pretty severe, and there's a lot of other things going on.
Can you recall an instance that you dealt with, an example that stands out in your mind of a traumatic brain injury in the field in Afghanistan?
Yeah. In February of 2011, we were on a patrol in by my outpost, and we had guys in the truck in front of me. Three guys in that truck hit a massive IED, and from a TBI standpoint, they all had differing levels. One of them was completely unconscious and a full-blown TBI, significant traumatic injuries. Another guy was semi-conscious and kind of delirious, and he had significant injuries as well. And then we had a guy that was just kind of what you would say is a mild TBI. And so at that point, we'll have to
come back with the rest of your story. Engrossing conversation. Nate Warner is with us, along with other Iowa veterans of Afghanistan and Iraq. Michael Hall, a neuropsychologist with the Veterans Administration, will come back as we discuss traumatic brain injury this hour. Also, we'll talk about a program called ICOVE, the Iowa Consortium of Veteran Excellence. We'll find out about that when we come back. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Traumatic brain injury, that's the focus. Tens of thousands of Iowans suffer from some degree of brain injury. We were talking about the degrees and also the advances, a lot of advances, technical advances, research advances, understanding. And what we're doing is advancing awareness about traumatic brain injury in the hopes of preventing it by learning about it. Here to help us do that, Michael Hall, staff neuropsychologist at the Iowa City Veterans Administration Healthcare System. He's director of the Iowa Consortium of Veteran Excellence, and his research has focused on a lot of post-deployment issues with a particular focus on the veterans' post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury. Also deals a lot with researching, working with rehabilitation as well. Three veterans in our studio as well, and one service dog named Traveler. You wanted Josh Mulder is one of our veterans. A shout-out to the folks who helped you out getting Traveler, because he helps you out a lot.
Yep, the company I got from, they're called Retrieving Freedom Incorporated. They're based out of Waverly, Iowa. And then they also have another, a sister location in Mississippi, I believe. And actually, we just want to say I'm graduating with my service dog on Saturday at 7 o'clock at the old Waverly Shell Rock Auditorium, Junior High Auditorium. and open to the public. There's going to be a lot of dogs there. Myself and six other veterans are going to be graduating then. All the puppies will be there that are being fostered right now for the company. It's also being put on by, I believe, a third and fourth grader. So there'll be a lot of kids there, a lot of dogs there. Be a good time.
All right. Josh Mulder is a veteran of Afghanistan. He sustained a blast-related injury while deployed as a Marine in Afghanistan. Nate Warner is with us, also a veteran of Afghanistan. Platoon medic Stephanie Woodell, also a veteran of Iraq in this case, and also a medic. When we left off before the break, Nate Warner, you were telling us about treating one specific instance of traumatic brain injury. A truck in your convoy hit an IED, an improvised explosive device.
Mm-hmm.
Pick up that story.
Yeah, so as I said, they hit an IED, and they all sustained pretty significant, and two of the three were critical life-threatening injuries, as well as their all three had TBI in varying levels. I said mild, and then a moderate to severe, and then a very severe TBI. In the field, it was just a consideration. There's not really you can do to treat TBI in the field. Like I said, the only thing I could really do as a medic on the ground is, keep him alive and stop the bleeding and so forth.
Well, after the explosion, was your company still under fire?
Yeah, it was a combat situation. A lot of times when you're overseas, when they do those blasts, sometimes they ambush you as well as a blast, so they'll blow a vehicle up in the convoy, and then when everyone comes out to treat the casualties, that's when they open up fire on you and engage you. And yeah, we were engaged in combat when we had our casualties, so we had to deal with those individuals as well as take care of our guys in that situation. So, we got through it, and we got a medevac out. And for me, honestly, I had dealt with TBI, like treating TBI in the past, but it had been pretty minor cases for the most part. But when after that incident, I took leave a couple months later, and the most severe of those casualties, it was a guy by the name of Adam Eilers, a good friend of mine. I went and saw him when I was on leave, and he had been fully concussed and was in a coma for, I think at least a month or two. And when I went and saw him, that was the first time that it really hit me that the whole TBI thing, like what it really does. When you're caught up in the moment, you don't really realize and you don't really think about the long lasting effects. But that's, when I went and saw him and saw how much it affected his cognition, it really opened my eyes.
Just a moment, I want to talk about ICOVE. That's the acronym. It goes by the Iowa Consortium of Veteran Excellence, because it's much broader than TBI, but we want to put it in this context. First, sure. This email from one of our listeners, Slayton in Mount Vernon. It's a little bit longer email, but I think it's worth it. He writes, "Our adopted son suffers from TBI as a result of shaken baby syndrome from the first 6 weeks of his life. We adopted him at 7 months and did not know if he would walk or be able to talk. We can't express our joy at his strength because today he presents as a normal 14-year-old boy who gets good grades and is a standout athlete in school. However, his TBI is always present in emotional outbursts over, quote, nothing, and his inability to control his impulses because the frontal lobe has been damaged and the limbic system controls fight or flight. We are amazed that even though adults in his life know he suffers from TBI, traumatic brain injury, they seem to be incapable of not forgetting it in day-to-day dealings or expect him to grow out of it. The amazing invisibility of this disability adds to its difficulty. No one would expect a blind person to see just because time has passed. But that is the expectation for TBI. We see improvements, but they come over years, not days." Thank you very much. That email from Slayton in Mount Vernon. You're nodding your head, Michael Hall, neuropsychologist. Matches up with
it. Absolutely. There's a number of just absolutely critical points in there. The silent nature of it. So this surprised me the first time I heard it, but I've now heard it enough times to realize the significance of it. But I've had people say, "I would rather have had an arm amputated than to have a brain injury, because at least then people wouldn't ask me what's wrong with me or assume that everything's okay." So certainly that silent nature, even those people who know it, we can lose track of that. And, dealing with traumatic brain injury over time is difficult. So when we talk about recovery, we don't talk in the terms that we would say talk about orthopedic injury. So you're going to be in a cast for 6 months. Recovery is slow. It may not be permanent. Person very well may not get back to that baseline state. And we hope with rehabilitation and supportive services that we can really help. So one of the things about that email that I really appreciate is both the positives and the negatives, the appreciation that there has been improvement, because I think we're going to see more of that as time goes, but also that warning that we need to be vigilant about this and understand that traumatic brain injury is a lasting issue. It can impact all areas of functioning, both cognitive, behavioral, mood, also ability to function in major domains. And approximately 95,000 Iowans are coping with long-term deficits tied to brain injury.
Do you find that attitude, Josh Mulder, you sustained a brain injury after a blast in Afghanistan. Do you find people expecting you to grow out of it with the passing of time, that it's not like blindness, that it will eventually just kind of heal like a broken bone?
Yeah, exactly, yes. And especially another big thing with TBI, it's one of those invisible injuries. People don't know I have this on a given daily basis, and they're just like, oh, nothing's wrong with you. Like when I walk around with Traveler, I'll actually have people come up to me like, oh, why do you have a service dog? Like, what's wrong with you? You're not disabled. But people don't actually keep in mind that it's an invisible injury that people can't see on a daily basis. And people don't know, like, really how to deal with it. It's like, oh, yeah, I have a TBI, like, what's it all do? And, like, they don't know how to deal. They see you as almost, like, handicapped.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk in the remaining 10 minutes we have of the program. Let's put this in the context of something called the Iowa Consortium of Veteran Excellence, ICOVE. And you are the director of ICOVE, Michael Hall. Give us an overview. And then each of our veterans are somehow involved in ICOVE. We'll get their views on it. But what is it?
Sure. So this is essentially a suite of services to help veterans transition from military service into post-secondary education through to full-time employment, with a particular focus on those individuals who are dealing with service-connected issues like traumatic brain injury. Although we hope to make the programming accessible to all veterans, because transition's difficult and veterans are coming in as non-traditional students. So this is funded through the VA Center of Innovation and is really a partnership between the Veterans Health Administration, Veterans Benefit Administration, Government Printing Office, University of Iowa, University of Michigan, and the Student Veterans of America. And very importantly, it's a collaborative endeavor with the student veterans, because what we don't want to do is develop programming that sounds good or is Ivy Tower-like but doesn't help on the ground. So there's four direct services for students. We do a transition course to help people reacclimate. There's a peer mentor program to build the sense of community on campus. We have couple and family workshops that are really not psychotherapy. They're real skills-based. Anybody could benefit from. They're fast-paced and very enjoyable. And then career assistance, with a real focus on helping people translate military experience into civilian terminology, encouraging people to get work experience while in school so that they are more hireable afterwards, and then also helping with placement. And we also work with employers going out and talking about the benefits of hiring veterans and the fact that they bring in leadership, they bring in real-life work experience, oftentimes in very hostile and difficult situations. Plus, there's tax incentives and those sorts of things. So we're also working to educate the faculty and staff, both as a whole and then student health personnel, on best practices. And so it's seven components to it in all.
All right. And we know colleges and universities across Iowa have plenty of veterans. Alone at the University of Iowa, hundreds.
So currently, I think over a million people, over a million veterans right now are utilizing GI benefits through the VA. Here at the University of Iowa, I think we're around 450 to 500. That number is increasing and expected to increase over time as well. So similar, not quite in the situation that happened after World War II, where veterans really changed the dynamics of education. We are seeing a large influx of veterans coming in who bring in a lot of non-traditional attributes to the classroom and to the campus.
Mm-hmm. Stephanie Woodell, you are one of those veteran students at the University of Iowa. You're a biomedical engineering student and a veteran of the Iraq War. served as a medic in Iraq, were deployed for 9 months. Tell us a little bit about your deployment. We don't have much time, but what you worked with and your involvement with the Iowa Consortium of Veteran Excellence.
Well, because we are a little short on time, I'm not going to go too much into the deployment. I was actually really lucky and was in a, what would be considered more of a non-combat situation and didn't have to deal with really trauma or brain, but just with the ICO program and the transition. School is tough as it is, and, you know, a lot of veterans come in with families and kids and everything, and that just all adds to the stresses of an already intensive program. And so ICO offers things to help with every aspect. My partner and I even did the workshop for the couples, and I mean, it was fun. It was non-invasive. It just gives you ways of.
Can you give me an example of a relationship you focus on relationships with ICOVA that a veteran would have that might be something that a civilian wouldn't have had. Are there typical scenarios, hurdles that you seek to overcome, helping veterans that typically aren't there in a civilian sector?
Well, with the veteran-civilian difference, there's usually a mindset difference in how things are done and structure and abruptness versus compassion. And so these workshops are skills-based and, you know, they help you understand that you just have to accept what it is. And once you accept it, you can work through it together. Mm-hmm. It's beneficial to everybody because if you have an argument at home, there you go. Now your school's messed up. Now your grades are going down. And it's just all very, very tough.
Nate Warner, a veteran of the Afghanistan, where you were a platoon medic. Tell us about your involvement with the consortium.
Yeah, the field I head up is called the PAVE program, which stands for Peer Advisors for Veteran Education. And as we're talking about with transitioning, a lot of veterans come into campus, and they're kind of a unique circumstance because you go from a life of rigid structure. You know, you have everything set out what you're going to do day in and day out. And then a lot of us come back, and we kind of, when we're in the service, we have that camaraderie, and then we get out and come back, and you have all the, you know, all the freedom you could ever possibly want, you know, compared to, you know, for us, where we're regimented constantly. And then, you know, a lot of people come in not knowing someone, and so there's kind of a disconnect sometimes. And what the Peer Advisors for Veteran Education aims to do is reach out to those veterans and give them a a link to reach out to so that, you know, they can get their, like, GI Bill stuff set up if they're having personal issues, anything, just to help them out as they transition. It's just a bridge, so to make things smoother and so their academics don't suffer.
Mm-hmm. Josh Mulder, how was your transition back to civilian life after your tour of duty as a Marine in Afghanistan and your injury?
It was definitely a lot tougher than I expected it to be. I got out of the Marine Corps, moved back home to Iowa, and I was going to college. I went to Kirkwood. I didn't even know how to register for classes. My sister, who was actually getting her master's degree at West Virginia, while she was doing her master's, she helped me register for classes. She helped me figure all this out because I was lost, and I didn't know how to do anything. And I ended up transferring to West Virginia. I was there for about a year and a half, 2 years. And she, once again, she helped me with all this. My sister, she was like a godsend when I came to college. And then when I moved back home, when I transferred back to Iowa last year, I really didn't have any problems at all between learning how to register for classes and meeting everybody. That was definitely a heck of a lot easier at Iowa. And then going to the vet center and actually meeting people and, like, making friends in West Virginia, I was basically out there by myself with my sister. And but when I transferred back home to Iowa, got to the vet center, met other veterans. They helped me with registration. They helped me with campus if I had any questions. They helped me with the GI Bill. Pretty much any questions I had, there was someone there who had that answer to help me provide and the building blocks that I needed.
As the hour ends, I want to circle back to our main focus, traumatic brain injury, because as we set out in the beginning, Michael Hall, this is a broad range.
Absolutely.
Of symptoms and injuries that can happen to our brain. People listening, wondering if loved ones are suffering from the after effects of a traumatic brain injury. Mm-hmm. Give us some advice, for instance, when to seek medical attention for first.
Well, first of all, right after the concussion, potentially. So if somebody has significant symptoms whereby there's altered mental status, there's changes in physical functioning, you know, we want emergent care then. We expect there to be several months after concussion for recovery, and if symptoms persist, then that's a good time. Hopefully people will keep their doctors in the loop during that time, but then we want to start thinking about potentially more aggressive treatment and interventions, because as you said before, the brain doesn't heal the way that say, a bone does, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And okay, here in Iowa, what are the resources available for treatment, rehabilitation?
Absolutely. So within the VA, we have a number of different programs within the polytrauma care, but I'll branch out. Beyond that, we have a great program in the state of Iowa. It's the Brain Injury Alliance of Iowa, and I encourage people to go to their website. They provide education, good education on answering those questions of when to seek help, what type of help to seek. They have neuro resource facilitators that can help with case management, can help with problem solving and providing services. And they also do provide training for providers who may not have a strong background. So I strongly encourage people to reach out there. The VA has developed several apps that are available to civilians. One's called the Concussion Coach, and you can get that off, I think, Android and the iTunes.
What does that do?
It walks you through, and it essentially does some symptom screening and then provides education and then contact information. Mm. So there's a Concussion Coach, and then there's a mild TBI pocket guide that might be helpful for clinicians, so identifying what could potentially be residual issues. Mm-hmm. So those are, you know, key resources.
What do you feel are – we talked about how awareness of traumatic brain injury is changing so
yes.
much so that we have professional football players, professional
yes.
athletes leaving without brain injury, but because of the potential mm-hmm. of brain injury, leaving their positions there on the teams. What are the greatest misunderstandings that you hope will be cleared up in the future?
Well, that brain injury is not a veteran, it's not a sports issue, it's an everybody issue. It's something that we need to take seriously. It's also something that if somebody does sustain a brain injury, that not to lose hope, that things can get better, that there are services available, and really to try to work through that adversity and try to develop as normal a life as possible is critical. Some of the other things, you know, particularly for veterans, is again sort of, you know, maybe falling back on some of those strategies that may have helped in the military. Leadership is a huge thing in the military, and I just wanted to do a quick shout out. Rick Williamson in the College of Dentistry has put together a leadership summit where he's bringing in some veterans with some pretty severe physical disabilities, hoping to expose high school students and the general public to that. So that'll be on April 15th, and I think that you know is a good avenue to look at rehabilitation and recovery in general, and it would apply to brain injury as well.
I understand, Michael Hall, you are vice chair of the Governor's Advisory Council on Brain Injuries
yes.
here in Iowa. Legislatively, what would be helpful from our lawmakers?
Well, so one of the things that a couple of issues of legislation is, one, we're moving towards privatization of Medicaid within the state of Iowa. So essentially, the long-term care of individuals with traumatic brain injury will potentially be taken over by managed care companies. It looks like the legislation was written in a way that there should be good oversight, but we want to make sure that mechanism does work in that capacity of advice. The Brain Injury Alliance has sponsored some really critical legislation, such as texting in teens, so as a primary offense, you know, because that is a key preventative factor, working on fall prevention, those sorts of areas, yeah. So, mm-hmm. so.
How do you see the three most common areas, of course, military, car vehicle crashes and also sports injuries very quickly. Do you see our knowledge about traumatic brain injury changing our sports?
I think it will change sports. I don't think there's a doubt about that.
Let me
move off of speaking for the government and just say, you know, another area of concern of mine is helmet loss, bicycle helmets and mm-hmm. motorcycle helmets. I see way too many people who are dealing with, you know, very significant and lasting problems resulting from things that potentially could have been mitigated or prevented. So wear your helmet. And, you know, as you get older, understand that falls are a greater risk. So making your home safe, shower safe, those sorts of things are absolutely critical. And information can be found out about this on the Brain Injury Alliance website.
Give us that website again, please.
Yes. So it's www.biaia.org.
Okay, very good. Michael Hall, thank you for being with us, neuropsychologist at the Iowa City Veterans Administration Healthcare System, also director of the Iowa Consortium of Veteran Excellence. It goes by the acronym ICOVE. And a big thanks to our veterans, Josh Mulder and Nate Warner, both veterans of Afghanistan. And Stephanie Woodell is a veteran of the war in Iraq. Stephanie, Nate, Josh, thank you also for coming in today to our studio.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Right. Thanks so much.
Tomorrow on our program, it's a News Buzz edition, also included in that program. Iowa City, the site after decades. This is the men's NCAA swimming championship being held in Iowa City. I'll take a visit to that place. You'll hear that tomorrow on the program. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. Also thanks to Julia Davis. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.